Welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron, and you are here for a very special birthday edition of the Matthew Aaron Show. That is right. Matthew Aaron is 36 today, August 15th, 2019, 36 years old. And I gotta tell you, I feel not a day over 56. Thanks, Pat, for making me work today. But we have a very special show. First of all, let me remind you where you can find us. www.thematthewaronshow.com. When I pay the bills, the website is up, and you got about 300 some episodes almost that you can check out, including this one today. And that may be where you're checking us out right now. If you're not checking us out there, I got a feeling you may be checking us out on Spotify, because our Spotify numbers have been through the roof. So maybe it's Spotify, under The Matthew Aaron Show, of course. Then you have iTunes, The Matthew Aaron Show. I think we're on Stitcher. We're on some other things that I don't keep as much track of. Of course, if you have any questions, concerns, comments, you have at Matt Aaron Show on Twitter. You got The Matthew Aaron Show on Facebook. And for those of you who have really, really searched me out and hate my guts that much, you have my email address. I know, because I've gotten the hate mail. So, today, we have a very special show. One of my very good friends is on the show today. He has a new movie coming out on August 30th, Don't Let Go. And that is Jacob Aaron Estes. Oh my God. This is the guy that wrote and directed Mean Creek. Let's not forget, that's a fucking classic. Okay? So Don't Let Go in theaters August 30th. We are going to do the oral history of that. And then I spent about 12 good minutes with Guy Nativ. And Guy Nativ has a new movie coming out based off his Oscar-winning short Skins. Is the feature film Skins with Jamie Bell. And we're going to be talking about that as well. But let's get right into it with my good friend, the director, the writer of Don't Let Go, in theaters from Blumhouse, from Tom Ortenberg, from Universal, in theaters August 30th. Here's Jacob Aaron Estes. All right, welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron. I am here with Jacob Aaron Estes, and we are doing the oral history of Don't Let Go. And Jacob and I, we were previously talking about how Don't Let Go had a couple previous incarnations. And I was talking about how I was at Jacob's house, and he got this script from Jason Blum, and at Blumhouse, and he was super excited about the concept of this thing. But you were like, I have to crack the script, the engine of the script. I got to kind of figure out. I may need a rewrite. But you were super into it. And so I kind of want to start there, where you just got this script from Blumhouse. Kind of take us through how this process happened, the very beginning.
So the very beginning of it is that when my daughter was a little girl, I used to read her this book called The Day the Crayons Quit. By this children's author named Drew Daywalt. And whenever I get a script that I didn't write into my inbox and I see the name of the author, I look up the
Do
name
a little
of the
Google.
Author.
Right.
Yeah. So I recognize this guy's name, and it was the guy that wrote this amazing children's book, Drew Daywalt. So that encouraged me to continue to read on.
You're fascinated at this point.
Yeah, so how did this guy that wrote a children's
nighttime book to...
yeah, and I had heard it was a horror movie.
Yeah.
So I was interested to see what is the guy that wrote The Day the Crayons Quit doing, writing a horror movie.
I didn't know that. That's crazy. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
My producing partner, she knows Drew, and We were talking about that, but I had no idea he was a children's author.
Yeah.
So then you get this horror script from a children's author that kind of makes you go, all right, I'm at least given this 10 pages, right?
Yeah. So and in the first 5 pages, there was this concept within a larger concept that Drew had constructed that I thought was fantastic and kind of like lit me up. And that was more or less that this family is massacred in this horrific murder that looks like a a murder-suicide by the father. And there's this uncle who is grieving, had a strong relationship with his niece, and the phone rings, and it's his niece calling.
Yeah, from the dead. I remember that's how you pitched it to me.
And so that actually made me hope. I was full of hope. And I thought, well, that would be an amazing engine for a movie. I went and did yoga and thought about the first five pages and then got back and continued to read. And actually, that turned out to, in Drew's script, that turned out to be a MacGuffin for a whole horror plot to do with monsters and serial killer in the basement. And I actually, you know, that had its merits. I just was interested in that. But I was deeply interested in
this phone call.
How is she alive? Who is she? Where is she calling from? And could that phone call represent something positive in the middle of all of this dread? That the characters were in, and maybe that we're in, you know, as people. So I'd worked on that idea and just started to, reiterate that idea throughout the course.
So did you take it back to Blumhouse and you're like, listen, I love this part of the script.
Exactly.
And I'd love to do something with this. And then what do they say when you take it over to Blumhouse?
Well, first I assumed that they wanted to make the horror movie.
Right, exactly.
So basically I just said, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And then a call came in from Jason, or maybe it was Cooper Samuelson, and they said, well, could you fix it? And I said, no, because it's not it. It's the it that I want to make was those first five pages, not the next 90.
Yeah.
And no disrespect to those next 90, they just weren't. I just wasn't interested at the time in making a horror movie like that. And so he said, well, really, could you maybe? Because we had talked about working.
Sure.
And I said, well, and this is super unusual in Hollywood, but it's a good story. I said, well, I wouldn't be able to speculatively go and like spend the next month figuring out how to make this. But you could pay me to think about it, and I will. And I just thought that's just going to get me nowhere.
Yeah.
Because no one's ever done that before. I've never even heard somebody.
No, I don't. I've never even heard of this either.
And they actually said yes, and it was wonderful. And
of course it's wonderful.
It was really wonderful. And I mean, there was a lot of faith, a lot of trust. And actually, I think, you know, we should do more.
They're thinking at some point something's coming of this.
Maybe.
Yeah, right.
You know, and
even if it's a different project, something, they're thinking something's coming out of paying him to think.
Well, but I also did think that there was something there
to
mine. And I just didn't know exactly what. But that process of figuring out how to reinvent everything is like highly speculative, and you never know what's going to happen. And so it was a leap of faith on my part and a leap of faith on their part, but we took that leap of faith together, and it turned out to be a win-win for us.
So at what point did you as a writer come up with the narrative?
So at that point, I started walking around Silver Lake Reservoir with a friend of mine named Jay Martin, who I produced one of his movies, and he makes music videos, and he storyboarded my movies in the past, and we started talking about the concept, and he would eventually become a producer on the movie. But we kind of walked around the lake enough times over the course of a couple of weeks where I felt like we had cracked the story together. And so, first I thought maybe he could become, an ampersand with me on story by, but I had already made a deal, so we ended up making him a producer on the project.
Yeah, that's great, though. So you kept the concept of the characters, the family, the uncle, the niece. You're walking around the reservoir, and you're thinking, okay, we have this time travel-ish kind of like
well, where is she calling
from? Right, where is she calling from? Yeah.
And I'm thinking all kinds of thoughts, like, maybe this is all in his head, maybe what we're doing is...
So is in part of this walk, you're like, the uncle's a police officer.
Yeah.
Thinking
maybe the uncle did it.
Right.
And this is some way of him, you know, sort of alleviating his guilt. And could that be a story? You know, thinking...
Because the theme of this movie, would you say, as the writer, the theme is guilt. There's hope, but it's also about grieving. I'd say grieving, not guilt.
I think grieving. I would put a big asterisk by that.
Yeah.
Which is that I think it's about the way in which we have these deep needs to believe and that the people that we've lost are still somehow there, and that feeling that somehow maybe you could reach through the fabric of the universe and pull them back to you.
And we still have a connection.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's about connection.
Connection, yeah. That's great. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So were you guys talking about how it's about connection to some degree when you're doing these walks and you're like...
I think we're largely talking around it.
Right.
Not actually knowing exactly what we're talking about.
You haven't pinpointed it yet, but you're broad strokes now.
Right. You're starting out with a plot that has to do with... literally a phone line connection between a person who's dead and a person who's alive.
Yeah.
And so you are talking about a connection whether you know it or not.
Right.
And that's often the sort of process that you go through while writing, is you don't exactly know what you're writing about.
Yeah.
Sometimes you think you know what you're writing about. Sometimes you've clearly identified it, but often you don't really know what you're writing
true.
About.
That's true. That's true. Especially plot details and stuff. That all comes along during the process.
There was this point where I just thought, like, the motor of the movie would be that David Oyelowo, well, it wasn't going to be David Oyelowo at first, we didn't know who it would be, but the character that David would eventually play, that he had this feeling, I can save her.
Yeah.
And I just, at every single step around the lake for several weeks in a row while we were conceiving of the plot, it was like that thought had to be in the fore of every decision he made, of every kind of plot point in the movie.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because we have all these comic book movies now, and everyone's going to go see these comic book movies. And I keep telling people about this movie, and I go, in a way, it's a comic book movie because we're dealing with a multiverse here, multiple timelines. I go, there really isn't a huge difference outside. There's no superpowers or whatever.
Right.
But it really. This is a film I think that should connect with general audiences because this is what they're craving for right now as it is. They love these multiverse kind of movies where we're bouncing around timelines. And I want to talk more about the timeline aspect of this, but let's go back to you write the first draft then finally. You and Jay figured it out. Mm-hmm. How long? Like a month or so you write the first draft?
Well, so sort of. I mean, I had an idea of what the movie would be.
Yes.
And then...
Do you got to repitch that?
I had already had the job, so
okay.
I had to kind of like tell them. And they affirmed that sounded good to them, and I started to write it. But then I went to Mexico, and I got extremely sick.
You were off the radar. I didn't know what happened to you. I thought you were traveling.
I got,
and then when I saw you, you're like, I almost died.
It's true.
So what happened?
So you
go to Mexico.
After a lot of forensic, medical forensics,
we
figured out that I had gotten dengue fever, which is given to you by a mosquito, which is a virus. But also I got typhus, which is given to you by a flea, and is a bacteria. And as a result of these two diseases kind of roaming my system all at once, my liver shut down.
I was
a liver failure.
And you're on vacation with the family, right? When this is going on?
Yeah. I was pretty close to death for a couple days, and I was pretty sure that I was saying goodbye, which sort of, you know, on the downside, I almost died. But on the upside, I kind of came out of that with this sort of new sense of purpose in my life, but also for the story. It was this you know, sort of one of the things that happened while I'm in the ambulance, light flashing, and I've got 105 degree fever, and I've just passed out on a dirt road, bleeding internally. I start to think, well, okay, my wife is, she's going to have a new husband, and she's going to get over her grief, and that's okay. And my 12-year-old daughter, she's old enough, she's had enough of her dad, but my 6-year-old son, I can't let him go. I have to live. He's too young. And this thought just kind of occupied my journey from the dirt road where I collapsed to the hospital that I eventually got to. And I think that sort of informs this sort of feeling in the movie of like not wanting to let go of your loved ones. And actually the title ends up being Don't Let Go.
I love that.
The movie several times, but Don't Let Go ends up
being, I love what you ended up with. Don't Let Go, I think, is like, I go, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's great. And like for our listeners, I briefly talked about this in a previous episode, but last year I went through similar. I almost died. I was stroking out, terribly out of shape, blood pressure through the roof, was really stressed. And as people know, I take care of my sister's 7-year-old. And it's just like, you have these thoughts. You do. You have these thoughts. I couldn't see. I was like blind. I'm like, I cannot die right now. He's 7. Who's going to put him through school? Who's going to, like, you have these like massive thoughts about not letting go. Yeah. And so I really connect to that. That was something we both shared in a recent time period. And for people at home that like hear all these near death stories and they think it's hyperbole, until it's happened to you, it is not hyperbole. Yeah. It's not a story construct. It's serious. Your life changes.
Yeah.
It changes. So that's just fascinating. So you're recovering.
And Jason Blum calls me. He's like, buddy, when is the script going to be ready?
You're almost dead.
Dying.
Yeah, right. That's what I was going to ask. So you're recovering and they want this movie. So you finally, when do you think you finally had the script? How many drafts in? Like,
well,
what do you feel it was?
So the story beats were so clearly laid out on a board in three acts, every single beat, and I had to write from an outline like that because otherwise the timeline issues would get completely out of control and I would just go down the wrong path.
I remember seeing a picture of your board for it, and it was insane.
It was.
Very detailed. You could tell you did not want to miss one detail with this thing.
Right. And eventually that board got all messed up in editorial. Combined scenes and moved things around and reconstructed everything, but when you're writing, sometimes it's good to have a plan.
It helps.
So really, I just wrote a draft, and it seemed good enough.
Yeah.
It seemed like, well, this is good enough that we can see, you know, the interest of actors and cast the movie. I mean, I'm sure there were a couple rounds of like notes.
Yeah.
In fact, there were.
Sure.
But it was very minimal compared to the 7 years I spent rewriting Mean Creek, or the like 45 drafts I did of the details. You know, I normally would spend a lot longer, working a script before putting it out into the world. But sort of just felt like either this has, you know, enough kind of balls up in the air for people to latch onto, or it doesn't. And I wasn't precious about it, and neither was Blumhouse. So we just kind of went and tried to cast it.
So they read it and they're like, "We think this is Ray for at least."
I remember what Cooper Samuelson said when he read it. He said, "Wow, this is still a genre movie. It's just not the genre that
right.
it was before." I said, yeah, it's not. It's a science fiction movie now. And they were, you know, just great, willing partners.
Yeah, which is a little different for Blumhouse. So that was cool.
A little different.
It's a little outside of what they're known for. But at the same time, they do sci-fi to a degree.
Yeah.
So this is, okay, so Cooper's like, This is good casting.
Yeah.
I love, and no political reason whatsoever. Here's why I love what you did. I love that you cast this with mainly African-American actors, Brian Tyree, who's fantastic. Yeah. He's the best. David Oyelowo, who's great. Stormy. Just great cast. But because you did it in South Central,
yeah,
I just felt like, oh, this is the story. This is good. It added an element to it. Didn't you feel shooting in South Central really gave your movie another character?
Yeah. So my first two movies, we shot on location in places that I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I've always thought, you know, like, that's really great. Because you go there with open eyes.
Yeah, right.
You look and you see things that locals don't even see, and they look beautiful to you or exotic to you or different.
That
to
people
you.
Take for granted or whatever.
Just,
yeah,
they're just driving by. So you get to kind of like go and look at things in a new way and kind of absorb it and find what's beautiful about it and what it would look like, you know, from the eyes of a child, more or less, right? And so I didn't know South Central LA very well at all, although my cinematographer lives like in the West Adams neighborhood, sort of bordering it. But, you know, so we just, you know, got into my truck and started scouting. Once I cast David, it wasn't even written necessarily for a black family.
Yeah, I was skipping a beat because I just felt like South Central, I had so much to the script. But originally, this could have been for anybody.
Yeah, it was written for a farmhouse in the Midwest.
Okay.
And then we gave, but I felt like the movie was not about identity or racial identity. It was about a family.
Yeah.
When David read the script and liked it, and we just went to him because he's a fantastic actor, you know, and I felt like
he is great.
Anybody can play this part. We'll just have to re-engineer the sort of window dressing around whoever takes it. When he said, "I'll do it," we had some technical problems to solve because it used to take place at a farm.
Right.
And there were gunshots that went off at the farm. Nobody heard them. And there was the reason why nobody heard them is there was nobody around. So we had to find another reason for that if we were going to go shoot it in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, David had said, "I would like to shoot it in LA." And I thought that was a great idea. But why would seven gunshots go off and nobody calls the police? Maybe because of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
So we started looking at neighborhoods like where gunshots might go off and nobody calls the police. So we go to South Central, we go to Watts, we go to all these different places in LA, and it's just amazing and eye-opening.
Yeah, it was great to see a sci-fi film filmed in South Central is really what did it for me. That was an added character bonus for me because we're so used to, we've seen Friday. We see a lot of urban movies in South Central, John Singleton movies, whatever, but you never see a sci-fi movie in South Central, so it has that like added element to it of just uniqueness. It's just very unique. I thought that was a really, you said David wanted to shoot in LA. That thought that was a masterstroke. I thought that's great.
Yeah, and sometimes this is just, you know, practical. I think like he wanted to shoot in LA because he wanted to be around his family.
Yeah, sure.
In the summer.
Yeah.
and so then you have to ask yourself, you know, like, well, what would it be like to shoot in LA? And sometimes the reason you choose something isn't for some like artistic reason, but it becomes an artistic blessing.
Yeah. Now when David has interest, is that your guy? As soon as he's interested, you're like, that's our guy.
Well, yeah, I was in Cleveland.
Yeah.
I was scouting houses outside of Cleveland in the middle of like, you know, farmland in Ohio.
Yeah.
And I got a phone call from my casting director saying David read the script and he loves it and wants to meet. And we just abandoned the scout in Ohio.
You're like, we're packing up.
I was at David's house the next day.
Oh, my God. So, yeah, that's how bad you're like, okay, this is
good.
Yeah,
I know. I mean, he's just such a great actor that you...
He's phenomenal, yeah. Great actor. I wanted to talk about Stormy, that she is so young.
Yeah.
You don't really know exactly what you're getting when you cast her. Because I don't even think Wrinkle in Time had been out yet. And I don't believe she was in a lot of 12 Years a Slave. Now, was there an audition process for her? Did you scout her out at all?
Yeah.
Chemistry read with David?
Sure, yeah. And we did, sort of top lines, we did know what we were going to get because she was willing to audition.
Sure. Who introduced you to her? Your casting director?
Yeah, my casting director said there's this, I mean, we went really wide and we looked all over
sure.
the place. And in fact, we almost cast the girl that, Shahadi, who was in Us.
Oh, wow.
I think that's how my casting director got to know her. and I said to my casting director, maybe even to Shahadi herself, like, this is your big break is that I didn't cast you because you got Us.
Yeah. Yeah.
You
know?
It's like, that's strange how life can work. But Storm read the script and came in and did a reading for me, just the way all the other actors had done it. And it was phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, it was just like, what I look for in an actor is more or less like, can I let that like horse run? You know, are they going to run? Do I really need, you know, to...
Yeah.
No, you just want somebody... You just want like somebody that's just going to do it.
Yeah.
And you just sit back and watch and redirect a little bit.
Yeah, you just feel like worst case scenario, you're tweaking.
That person is so strong. Yeah. And that's what you could just see. Each choice she made in her audition was grounded and visceral and connected. And yeah. She's an actor. You know,
yeah.
It's obvious. So then we had her come and meet David and... we did a little, they sat around by the pool and
yeah.
talked, and then did a little reading of the script in front of me and the casting director. And I look over at my casting director, Terry, and she's crying, watching this emotional scene. And that's when it was just abundantly obvious.
Yeah.
But I still didn't know if David thought that. And after Storm left, he said, she's the one. Absolutely. There's no question. Yeah,
well, that's great. Yeah. So that's easy for you.
Yeah.
There was no haggling over who we're going to put in this thing.
No, it was just so obvious
yeah.
at that point.
Yeah. What? So then you got. Are we talking about Brian Tyree Henry, who's just.
I had never seen Atlanta.
The greatest.
I had never.
You
seen
hadn't. Atlanta. I feel like that was your show.
I
almost hit you up to talk about that show like three times.
So you know, that was just strictly
because it's up your alley. You would love Atlanta.
I do love it.
Okay, you've seen it now, yeah.
But I hadn't seen it, and Terry Taylor, the casting director, said, have you ever seen this guy, Brian Tyree Henry? And I said, no, because I basically like been raising kids for the last
right.
5 years, not paying
It's harder to watch anything, yeah. Yeah, when you got kids, yeah.
And I said, but I'd love to meet him if he wants to meet. And so we went and had coffee and met, and yeah, he was charming.
Yeah.
And he's this wonderful presence to sit with, and I get home and he texts me like, you better watch the first episode of Atlanta.
Still doing the hustle.
I was like, okay. And I turned it on and I watched him play Paperboy. And by the end of the episode, I was
yeah.
calling David saying, I think he looks nothing like you, but I
yeah.
think we found your brother.
Yeah,
and,
totally.
You know, there was this question of, he looks nothing like you. Which, you know, I was really comforted by this thing that actually Angela Bassett once said to me when we were meeting on another project where she was claiming that she could play a 25-year-old character.
I'm sure.
At the time. And I said, you know, I love you, but I don't. And she said, Jacob, in the theater, if you say it's so, it's so. And so that became, okay, David and Brian don't look alike, but if you say it's... They're brothers.
Yeah.
They're brothers.
Yeah.
And there's another explanation. Maybe they had a different father.
I never doubted it watching it. You never think about it.
You never. I mean, you've got these two great actors.
Yeah.
And they're brothers.
Yeah. And by the way, because of the way they're written and the way the relationship is written, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, that makes more sense than who cares how close they look alike to each other. They nailed the relationship between the two of them. And for two actors who don't really spend any real screen time together, like to nail the relationships from afar. Yeah. That was a sign of real good acting.
Yeah.
They like got it. They yeah. got it. And that's good writing too.
They're never in the same
right,
scene.
Right, never in the same scene, but we believe they've been to barbecues and they've yeah. been hanging out with the family, and he's always had a problem with Brian Tyree's character, and Brian probably always looked at David as the stuck up like cop of you just got it. You really nailed it. So that was great. Yeah, I love Brian Tyree. My favorite guy is in the movie. He's not in a ton of it, but I always tell people, see anything Fred Molina's in.
Yeah.
He has exquisite taste in everything.
Yeah.
It's very rare you see Fred do something that's garbage.
Right.
So that's always a stamp of approval right away. if Fred does your movie, yeah. he likes it.
Yeah.
He likes it. And
you're clearly on a first-name basis with him because his name is Alfred.
Alfred Molina, right? Right.
His friends call him Fred.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm a huge, much more of a fan than a friend, but big fan is. We've had a couple encounters, and he's as sweet as you think, but slyly funny, like really funny.
Yeah.
And what did he bring to this for you? There's like how would you explain what Alfred Molina brings to this movie?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's just pure joy to work with.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And again, another actor where you have to do very little.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of preparing them for what they're going to do, other than listen to them while you're doing rehearsals.
Yeah.
Incorporate their thoughts. I just sent him with my costume designer, Nadine, off to create the look. And,
yeah.
You know, they created that together without my input, really. I just sort of said, yeah, that looks good. Or, yeah, that looks good. Or, I prefer this to that. So, you know, you get an actor like that, and you can let them be in charge of their own thing, and let them intuit, you know, sort of the tone by sitting around in a rehearsal or talking to the other actors, or just, you know, they're going to listen.
Yeah.
So you just have a pleasurable experience working with that guy.
So at this point, movie's greenlit. Pretty much as soon as you get David, it's like a go.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's greenlit. You're doing pre-production at this point now in South Central because
yeah.
David's convinced you, let's do it in L.A.
Yeah.
So what comes next? Did you hired your DP because you've worked with your DP before.
Yeah.
So that was just like a slam dunk. That wasn't a...
Yeah, it was a known...
A process.
It was a known thing.
Yeah.
And he was a known entity to Blumhouse because he shot Whiplash for
Right, Whiplash, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. With J.K. Simmons and yeah, right. That's
exactly.
right. That's right.
Yeah.
Great looking movie too.
Yeah.
Yeah, great job. And great job on this too. There's a couple shots in this. And the way South Central shot, I just felt like... It's shot differently than I've ever seen South Central shot, but if you go to South Central, you feel like the movie, like the feelings there.
Yeah,
did a really good job with that. How much scouting went into, like you said, you usually go to unknown areas, South Central, you guys know a little more. So what
your
DP did. He knew a lot.
A little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, he knew a certain part of it. So I just started. So the movie takes place at a police precinct,
yeah.
In part. So I got a map of LA and all the different. And I sort of Googled police departments, and so I went from police department to police department to police department as part of my scout.
Yeah.
And weirdly, all these commanding officers just like would let me into the station.
Oh yeah, no.
Tours without even any setup. I just had to
show
my ID and they checked my name on.
They let us shoot some of our movie at the police department in Chicago. I went there last second. We were supposed to shoot at one police department, and the day of, the chief of police like vetoed it.
Uh-huh.
So then we called another police department, and the chief of police was like, "Come shoot here."
Yeah.
And I was like, "Oh, this is so welcoming, and like I don't have to like pay for this or."
Yeah.
They were so nice.
Yeah,
we had a great experience with the police department shoots.
Yeah.
It's interesting you had that. Did you shoot an actual police department?
No.
Okay,
we had
so it's
much
a stage.
To shoot there. It was the it's like not the Elks Lodge. It's like one of these like Mason lodges.
Okay.
In South Central, like on 55th and Western in that area. And they let us take over the downstairs and sort of revise it to make it like a police station. And then we shot some stuff in the upstairs that already looked like a police station.
It looks so much like a police station. How much went into building that downstairs? Was it
Well, we scouted all of these real police stations, both in L.A. and when I was in Ohio. And there was another state that we were in at some point looking. And so I had done a lot of documenting. As did my production designer later. And so a lot of the looks we got straight out of, you know, real police stations.
Yeah.
And we just, you know, had a color palette and went for that color palette.
Is that where, like, a lot of the production design cost went into building the police station?
All $12.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, because there's not a lot.
Yeah, there's not a lot. But it's very art.
But it's done so well that I'm like... Well,
that's the testament to Celine Dion.
Okay.
To the just... You know, kept rubbing nickels together and figuring out
how
things happen.
That's insane. Yeah. Wow, that's incredible. Because a lot of people don't know, like, an episode of Law and Order SVU costs more than a Blumhouse movie, Blumhouse movie.
Right.
So you have, like, all this money they spend on production design and building sets and everything.
Yeah.
People don't understand that, like, with these smaller movies, you have to, like, rub nickels together and make it work. But there's no sacrifice to quality with this. None.
Right.
So that's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that police station, I thought it was one you were at.
Yeah, I know.
You shot on location the whole movie.
It's a bunch of factors coming together, to including just casting the right extras.
Yeah.
You know, using existing space.
Yeah.
So scouting and finding an existing space that you could imagine being redressed and repainted and redesigned, you know, and then figuring out, you know, just clever ways to give it a sense of reality.
Sure. Yeah. Now, did you know, we were talking about this beforehand, and I told you this was, as a writer, my favorite part of this thing where you turn it on its head. About halfway through the picture, it goes from being David's story to Stormy's story, as the lead narrator, I would say. Did you know you were doing that? Like, when you were writing it, you're like, we're going to flip it here? Or was it just something that, you know, like you said, when you write, you know what you're doing, you don't know what you're doing, and you figure it out?
Well, we knew that somewhere inside the story, the movie would go from David's story to two-hander.
Yeah, right? Yeah, two-hander. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
To these two competing, opposing, interwoven timelines, and we would start to track both of them. But in editorial, I did realize, all through prep and all through shooting the movie, I didn't realize just how important it was to bring that to the foreground. And I think, you know, one of the sort of casualties of making a movie where you don't have a big budget is that, for instance, the movie takes place largely on a cell phone.
Yeah.
Between these two characters, we're on a cell phone. And one of the ways I decided to save money and, like, make everything feel, like, bigger was to reduce the number of times we would see Storm's character
right.
in the first half of the movie. So in the first draft of the script, it was as if we were going to shoot the same scene twice every time. Her on her phone,
David
on his phone. And what I realized is that actually what we're craving is for them to be in the same room. As an audience, we want that connection we established in the beginning.
Yeah.
We want it back. So I thought, so this production problem of we can't shoot 200-page movies. What we can do is we'll shoot 100-page movie, basically, and we won't see Storm, by and large, in the first half. And then when we finally see her, that'll be our reward.
Right.
So,
but there's a twist to that, too.
Yeah.
Because she's seeing her uncle, who has no fucking clue what's going on at all. This is a different David at this point.
Right. Well, so David is in both timelines.
Yeah, right.
David is in one timeline, he's grieving the loss of his entire
and
family.
Trying to solve this case.
Talking to his niece, who is in another, who is dead, but he's alive in her own timeline. And then in her timeline, there is another David. There is an uncle.
Who's still alive.
Yeah, we would call him
Satan. Or I mean, she's still alive.
She's alive.
In this timeline still.
And he's completely naive.
This is like two days or 3 days before her murder or whatever. Right. And she's now figured it out kind of halfway through. Right. But now the David's character has no clue.
Right, there's a David. Yeah. There's a David Oyelowo in her timeline who's just going about his business.
Yeah.
Nobody's killed anybody.
Yeah.
And if she were to talk to him about the scenario that her other version of her uncle has told her about, the whole universe could explode.
And it keeps them, like, and we've talked about this as writers, it keeps the movie really fresh, too. Because it's like, you could have still done a great job just having David lead the whole way. But when it kind of becomes Stormy's movie, it's like this now, like, fresh approach to this thing. And I felt like we're going into another gear. Like, well,
for me also, sort of spiritually, what I realized was to tell a story about a young girl, 12, 13 years old, having her own agency to solve her own crime was important to do.
Yeah, I think that was
so great. So we went and did a reshoot, not a reshoot, additional photography.
Sure.
Seeing more of her doing more stuff to sort of emphasize that fact.
Yeah, yeah. So then you guys are done shooting. What is the process like with putting this movie out? It's at Blumhouse Tilt, which is their genre division. Mm-hmm. And then it ends up with Tom Ortenberg's company. Mm-hmm. And then you do Sundance. Explain to me the whole post-production, like, insanity to get the movie out.
Oh, God. Well, we cut the movie for practically a year in good faith before Sundance. And that process was, you know, sort of very normal studio process where I would cut. I would get notes. We would cut again. We did test. We tested
the movie.
Do some
testings.
We got feedback. We kept refining, and we got to a place with the movie where it was scoring well, and it felt, you know, as short as it was going to be, which was sort of, you know, part of the process of making the movie was not letting me make like a, you know, sprawling 4-hour epic, but like find like the sort of dense thriller, you know, of it all. And we submitted it to Sundance when we got in. But what I found at watching the movie with that audience at Sundance was that I had maybe, I think I had stripped back too much of the soul.
Yeah.
It got too dense. There wasn't enough of the, like, sort of gristle of the emotion that...
There's not enough breathing going on.
Not enough breathing. And we had removed a major red herring. We had removed a sort of big payoff to the time travel element. And so I went back to the first cut and looked at what it had in it that I loved. I kind of transplanted that back into the cut post-Sundance and did that very carefully in concert with my producers and with David Oyelowo, who became a producer on the project over the course of the project. And we finished it. And
so after Sundance, at Sundance it's titled Relive. What made you retitle it Don't Let Go?
Well, so when we, at the first title of the script that I wrote was called Only You. And that was because character who would eventually be played by Storm Reid.
Right. I remember when it was that too. I really liked the title, but I'm like, but I think it's a romantic comedy if I haven't seen like a trailer or anything.
There was some context for that title, which was that Storm's what made a music video to this song by Yaz. Only when I cast Storm, I thought that that version of Ashley, which is the character's name, doesn't listen to Yaz.
Yeah.
You know, her dad is a musician in the movie and hands her old music, but he didn't hand her Yaz.
Yeah.
Brian Tyree Henry was listening to something else.
Yeah.
So I chose a different song, and it wasn't called Only You, And I eventually cut the music video that she made out of the movie altogether. And so Only You just became this title that just wasn't really viable.
Yeah.
For the reasons you mentioned, to do with, like, it's confusing. Now
yeah.
It sounds like a romantic comedy.
Yeah, right.
And it has no connection to the interior of the movie. So we, at that point, like, started kicking around titles, and it became like...
And you need to have something for Sundance, so you're under the gun, probably.
My mind melted. And yeah. we ended up with this title, Relive, which my friend Jay, who worked on the, you know, the beat outline,
with yeah.
me, would eventually say, it sounds like a laxative.
Yeah.
So after Sundance, we had an opportunity to rethink
yeah.
Relive, both on an editorial level and on a titling level. And Jason called me and he was like, well, what are the other titles you've been thinking about? And one of them was Don't Let Go.
Yeah.
And we all said, okay.
I think that one's the winner, yeah. It's a good one. I liked it. I was really, when Hillary went and saw it at Sundance and she's like, it's Relive now. I'm like, well, I don't know if I love that. I told her that. I'm like, I don't know if I love that. But then when I heard it was Don't Let Go, I go, perfect, money, that's good. I like that. It really sells the drama of it. It sells, yeah, yeah. There's mystery behind it. There's some mystique to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like that a lot. So then it ends up with Tom Wartenberg and OTL. How did Tom get involved? Because we love Tom Wartenberg.
Tom, we were looking for the way that it was going to get distributed.
Yeah.
And Universal is still on board as OTL.
That's sure.
One of their labels. And Tom Wartenberg came on board loving the project for his own personal reasons.
Yeah.
And pitched Universal how he would, you know, do it. And that's what happened.
Yeah, yeah. Tom's great. That's a good supporter to have on yeah. any project, though.
Yeah.
For those who don't remember, like, we've talked to Tom. We talked about Tom with Thomas McCarthy about Spotlight,
uh-huh.
famously.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Tom is a very strong believer in that mid-range budget filmmaking still, and he's a strong proponent for it, and he great guy to have on your team.
Yeah.
So that's great, man. And so the movie's coming out end of the month.
August 30th.
August 30th.
Yeah.
And this is exciting, man. David was on James Corden last night.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, that's cool.
Uh-huh.
I mean, dude, you got to be excited, right?
I'm excited.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Usually this is the part where I ask what else you got going on, but you basically told me nothing. So you're like, you're like top secret.
Too much going on. Focus on what it is exactly that I've got going on.
No, but I'm excited for you, man. I was being your friend is great because I got to be there at the start of this journey. And I know how much this movie means to you. And I want people, we have a lot of listeners who want to be filmmakers. And if you knew how much this movie meant to Jacob throughout the whole process and how much he really wanted to make it, that's how you make a good movie. Like, you have to have the passion to make a good movie. Like, you have to just be in love with it. And so I just remember from day one when you were in love with this script. So I'm so happy that it got made. I got to see all the process of it getting made, kind of a learning experience for me because I've just done smaller films and I got to watch you do something bigger. So it was great. I'm so proud of you. I'm so happy for you. You're like family to me. I love you.
Oh,
and so, it means a lot to me that you took some time out to do this. And
thank you for podcasting.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. I hope I hope people really treasure this one because I mean this is quite the story. I mean, especially with the whole episode with you in Mexico is just insane. That stuff that you read in books, you know. So
when David Oyelowo is dying in the ambulance in the movie,
yeah.
That's basically what he sees is what I was seeing.
Oh, my God.
And that's probably what I looked like.
Yeah, I mean, when I had my moment, I just kind of like went blind. And you just don't even want to think about it ever again. It's too much. But thanks, Jacob. And August 30th, Don't Let Go. Everyone go check it out. Enjoy. Jacob Aranestis, I mean, that was quite the oral history for that film. I think if you wanted to know how a Blumhouse film is made, we pretty much dissected it there for you. And you can see Don't Let Go in theaters August 30th
It is going to be one of the sleeper hits of the summer. Enjoy it now. Now, coming up, we have Guy Nativ. What a story this is. Skins. He tried to get financed as a feature film. So he decided, I'm going to go make a short, thanks to some advice from Oren Moverman. He goes and makes the short. The short was made just to get financing. It ends up winning a fucking Oscar for best short. They go out, they get Jamie Bell, and now you have the feature. This is Guy Nativ talking about Skins.
All right, this is Matthew Aaron. I'm here with Guy Nativ, and we are going to talk about Skin, which is exclusively on DirecTV right now, but it's going to be in theaters July 26. So, Guy, I just wanted to talk to you. I know we were discussing how this became a short first and then a feature, and a lot of people are told in film school, go make a short and you'll turn it into a feature. But you never really wanted to make a short. You kind of were put in a position to make a short, from how I understand it, where you wanted to make a feature, but you couldn't get the financing. So this was kind of a proof of concept. Is that correct?
Yes. I moved from Israel to LA, and I wrote the script about Brian Weidner after I met him in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I wrote a script, and it was 2016, and you know, Obama was president, and no one thought from the Hollywood producers that this film is actually real. They said it's a great script, but it sounds like a sci-fi, because you know, there's no really neo-Nazis in the States, and it's like, sounds like a more European film. Maybe you should do it in Germany. And I was like, you guys, I made the research. I know what's going on here. I know that it's real. And it didn't work. And I was frustrated. You know, producer after producer said no. And we didn't know what to do. And my wife told me, look, all your features were shorts before. And let's make a short to make the feature happen. Show proof of concept, show that you can work with American actors and with American production and make something.
Now, was there ever a fear that you're like, because you obviously know the process, you've made a lot of shorts, and shorts are not always financially a great idea, right? There, it's a lot of, you're making a film, but there's not a lot of places to make money off of a short. So is there any fear at all of, oh God, we're going to be flushing money down the tubes doing a short about this, and I should just keep working on making it a feature?
You know, my wife and I treat it as a startup.
Yes.
Totally a startup. This is like you invest money in something that might work and might not work. So, but we believed in the subject matter, in the story, and my way of making films. And it's not my first rodeo. I made films and shorts in Israel, and I was eager to
start. Award-winning shorts, too,
yes,
by the way.
Thank you so much. Yes. And I was eager to start working in the States, and I made we made a short. We put all our retirement money into this short. It's insane. And we just sent it out to the world. And while we were sending it out to the world, Trump got elected.
Charlottesville, yeah.
And obviously the synagogue massacre. Mm. And it was insane. The country was like basically on fire. And those producers were like, oh, we get it. Now, at the same time, Sting, the musician Sting,
yeah,
and Trudy saw the film, and Sting said it's probably one of the best short films I ever saw, and he said you got to be involved in the feature. Oren Moverman was involved in the beginning. You know, he believed in it in the beginning, but he didn't have the
Oren Moverman, I want to get to that. Oren's one of the producers, or the executive producer.
No, producer.
Producer, okay. Because he was very involved.
Very involved.
And most people don't know the difference between executive producer and producer roles, but he was so involved. He's a producer in this thing. And I remember he gave the script to Jamie Bell, correct?
It was his idea to bring Jamie Bell.
Yeah.
Because he met him 2 weeks prior to me meeting him, Jamie Bell. And he said to me, you gotta meet Jamie. He's not a boy anymore.
Yeah.
This is not the kid from Billy Elliot. This is like a man. He's divorced now. He has a kid. He's like, he went through stuff. And I drove from New York to Virginia, and I met Jamie. He was shooting a TV show then, and I met this man who I told him, you are Brian. And he's like, me? I'm not.
Like, as soon as you met him, you felt like you're Brian?
Yes, because he's you could feel that he's hurt. Mm. You could feel his humanity. You could feel his emotional. He's super intelligent. And I saw that, of course, we need some work. We need some to bring you there, but I totally saw it on him. And he said, really? I mean, he told me, I'm a little scared to enter this role. I'm a little terrified.
Yes, yes.
But that's a good thing, because if I feel nothing towards role, it means nothing to me. So it means that I'm checking the dark side of in myself. Mm. And I told him, listen, take your time. I'm here waiting for you. Just let me know.
Let me know.
And once we cast Danielle in the role.
Now, Danielle was in the short as well.
Yeah.
And so was it easy transition to get Danielle to do the feature then? Or?
For me, it was.
Yes.
It was obviously, the first go-to of a lot of producers.
No. How did you get Danielle on the short?
Well, she babysit my dogs. I babysit her dogs.
I heard something like we're neighbors. Yes. Okay. Okay. So Danielle was kind of an easy. I mean, obviously the script still has to be good, but she just did Patty Cakes. I'm imagining
just
around
patty
this
cakes.
Time. Before she blew up, this was.
She.
You're like, come do my short.
Yes.
This role will be great for you. She's so good in this movie. She's so good in this movie. Oh, I told you before we started, Jamie's great, and Jonathan Tucker in the short was great, and I want to talk about that for a moment too. But Danielle is, man, she's going to be one of the greatest actresses of her generation. She really will.
I mean, she is already a star. She's like great.
Yes,
she's amazing. I mean, I want to work with her and Jamie through my entire life. I just want them. And every single movie
I make.
Right,
I understand
and Vera.
That. I
and
understand. Vera's fan.
And Bill Camp.
Yeah.
Can I have the same cast?
Yeah,
over
right.
Over again.
Well, what's interesting is, too, and I want to talk about this, is we're making a similar film right now. Ours is about the following 5 days after Trump gets elected, but in the life of a family. We want to see how it affects the family structure, the changeover from Obama to Trump.
Very powerful.
And we have this issue right now where we can't cast one of the leads. Excuse me, guy. We can't cast one of the leads because it's the role of a Trump supporter. And we get a lot of feedback that, like, actors don't want to play Trump supporters. Now, you were talking about how Jamie was like, ooh, I don't know if I should even do this.
Yeah.
Because Bill Camp, though, let's talk about this. Whatever Jamie has to go through, Bill Camp's the evilest
motherfucker.
You're on the same page. Evilest motherfucker on the.
Not NPR.
Yeah, we're fine. We're not NPR. Evilest motherfucker you could ever imagine. How do you get Bill Camp to do this role?
First of all, Oren knows him very well.
Okay.
I mean, he brought him. He's a New York legend. And it was me talking to him in a coffee shop. And he's reading a role that is not only villain, but it's a damaged villain. Somebody that lost kids before, somebody who's like a shadow of himself. And it was in New York, so it's also kind of like location-wise, it was close to home. And he saw that Danielle is there, McDonald, he saw my short.
Mm.
I think the short was, the short was a big...
That's a proof of concept, everyone says.
You see, it's also make... An actor, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, with the short, did you have a...
Yeah. So,
I'll
be the last question.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah. So, with the short, was Oren involved then as well? And then...
Oren was my advisor.
So, he advised you through the short.
Yeah.
Now, we were talking about earlier, Jamie Bell did great in this film. I would be remiss not to ask about Jonathan Tucker was in the short.
I know.
Wins an Oscar. Fantastic short.
You like
it? Oh my god. When I found out that you weren't even trying to make an Oscar picture though, like it was just like, oh, we made this short and everyone likes it. Let's see what happens. Yeah. I was so jealous of you.
Oh, okay.
In a good way where I'm like, oh my god, he was really just trying to get financing for a feature.
Yeah.
and he ends up winning an Oscar for a short. What a crazy world. But Jonathan Tucker's so great in it. Why did the process go from Jonathan to Jamie? Because he kept Danielle. So that's why I'm asking.
Okay, here's the reason that Hollywood dictate is the American way. If it was in Israel, of course I would take Jonathan Tucker. Jonathan Tucker is a brilliant actor.
Brilliant.
Like, I would say that it's so funny. He and Jamie Bell are both in the same gym.
So really?
They both met each other. Like,
oh my God.
It's so funny. But the rules of making films in the States mean that you need to have a name that is valuable for distribution, and Jamie was more valuable than Tucker. When I told my producers that I want Jonathan Tucker, they told me his name is not valuable yet.
Yeah.
Yet. Maybe now he will. But Danielle exploded with Patty Cakes. So she was the new thing. She was the new name that everybody remember because she's... And again, we're talking movies. We're not talking TV.
Yeah, right. Right?
So they explained to me, you need somebody who has valuable name.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about a $20 million film. This is like 2.5 or 3.
Yeah.
So... They
beautiful job, though, by the way.
Thank you so much.
I know how hard it is to make a film for even, like, not even that much money. Yeah. And it's you did such a great job.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
You did such a great job. It's gorgeous.
Thanks.
It's gorgeous. And it's not... I mean, it's hard calling a film like this gorgeous to look at, but it is. It's... You and your DP did such a great job.
Arnaud Poutier.
Yeah, it's such a great job telling a story through the picture.
Thank you.
Through the visuals.
So you know what I mean? You need
that. Unfortunately Jamie meant more to financing.
Yeah, that's it. That's the reason.
Gosh. Okay, well, God,
I will work with him in the future. I bet
because he's
so good.
You guys had magic together in the short, and Jonathan is one of the greatest actors I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And Jamie's great.
I know.
So you got really lucky too with the changeover.
Thank you so much, man.
It's my pleasure.
And
I wish I had more time, but
good luck
yes, I thank you so much. And just once again, let's remind people: July 26th in theaters, and right now on DirecTV, exclusively on DirecTV. So thank you so much, Guy. I just want to thank both my guests today. That was Guy Nativ talking about Skins, which is out now. You can see it on DirecTV. I think you could still maybe catch it in theaters. Not positive, but Guy Nativ, Skins, check it out. Really good film. The film that I'm excited about, you're excited about, August 30th, Don't Let Go. Jacob Aaron Estes, written and directed, starring David Oyelowo, starring Stormy Reed, starring Brian Tyree Henry, starring Alfred Molina, starring Mikelte Williamson. That's a film you gotta see. Don't Let Go, in theaters August 30th. Thank you for joining me, Jacob. Thank you for joining me, Guy. And I'm going to see you next time on The Matthew Aaron Show here at www.thematthewaronshow.com. Thank you very much, and happy birthday to me. Thanks for making me work today, Pat Tobias.